This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
I'm thrilled to welcome you, dear listeners, to another episode of our Think and Drink series in collaboration with the Georg Simmel Center for Urban Studies at the Humboldt University in Berlin. Today's speaker is Andrei Semenov, an assistant professor at the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the Nazarbayev University in Astana, Kazakhstan. Andrei's talk uses examples from Eurasian countries to explore the conceptual underpinnings, strategies, and practices of authoritarian urbanism, arguing that authoritarian urbanism pursues two simultaneous, yet somewhat incompatible goals: providing rents to ensure the elite's loyalty, and satisfying the mass demand for housing, as well as a comfortable urban environment. Well, we hope you enjoy the episode.
I'm coming from an authoritarian country, and the title, the kind of hints into that, I'm going to talk about the authoritarian urbanism in Eurasia, mostly Russia, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan. But of course, like coming from these countries or living, I also worked in the US and Europe, but most of my life is connected to authoritarian Russia, meaning that probably I understand some things better than those who are outside, but also it clouds some of my perceptions. So I have to say something about that. Also, like with maybe most of those who are coming from this kind of context, I hate dictators, and it might also affect my judgment, but I'm happy to reflect on that. And actually, it also moves me to understand dictatorships better. Second of all, I'm a comparativist. So basically, I'm coming from the mainstream political scientists, meaning that, again, unlike geographers, sociologists, we have some assumptions, some consensus about what is authoritarianism, what is autocracy, and what is not. And again, it might be limited, it might be narrow, and I'm happy to discuss that as well. But this is, again, background, the mainstream political scientists, which is basically positivist, empirical, and comparativist in its core. Third of all, my research experience is mostly coming from Russia and also Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. But the title is Eurasia, and Eurasia is an imaginary geographical construct that encompasses also China and Kyrgyzstan, other Central Asian countries. Sometimes also it can be Azerbaijan and the other countries. But basically, I think in terms of research, my expertise and my knowledge is coming from three primarily countries. And I'm happy to talk whether we can generalize some of the things that I want to present here today to other contexts as well. So yeah, this is the setup. And again, I'll be happy to hear your thoughts on the substantive part. So I'm going to start with some puzzle. The thing that puzzles me when we talk about authoritarian urbanism or things related to authoritarian urbanism, I'm going to proceed with some conceptual clarifications. There are so many interesting concepts like neoliberal authoritarianism, neoliberal authoritarian urbanism, and all sorts of these kind of things. And I think it's warranted that we start discussing, clarifying these concepts and maybe putting them in a more tight, consistent manner. Then I had some examples, and then it's going to be some conclusions and ways forward to some general discussion. So my puzzle is the following. There is a growing literature on authoritarian urbanism. There are wonderful studies done across the context, like Belgrade, like Serbia. Istanbul, Turkey is one of the major suppliers for studies of authoritarian urbanism or urban development connected to autocracies. There are also recently there is an expanding span for geography of the authoritarian urbanism studies. So there's a wonderful study of Bangkok in specializing authoritarian hook. And it's a very interesting case of how, again, government in Thailand is trying to use urban development practices in order to gain the loyalty of elites and also the core constituencies. What puzzles me in this picture is that we can see that I've tried to tease out what are the features that all these wonderful scholars are mentioning in their studies, in their cases across these studies that might be connected to authoritarian urbanism. It's quite a diverse exercise I did with the specialized in authoritarianism, the wonderful review of Natalia Koch edited volume, and I did the same. So I tried to track what these features across these cases are mentioned in these studies. Actually, you can, if you just, so one thing to note here is that there is a diverse map of these features. People can, scholars can mention, say, centralization or selective use of plan and instruments or financialization of urbanization. But if you just narrow it down to the things that are mostly mentioned across the studies, for instance, here across these four studies, it's just centralization or decentralization in case of Turkey, and wide use of coercion. And I think one thing, again, for us to, what I'm struggling with is, again, why these particular cases? Again, why use of coercion is not very, very uncommon in democracies as well, and in urban developments as well. In the Tripart project with Daniela Supen and the others, we also found out that coercion can be used in a semi-authoritarian, non-democratic context. So it's not really clear why the use of coercion should be the feature that defines authoritarian urbanism. And if you follow, again, the Natalia Koch, wonderful book, wonderful collection of studies, she claims in the introduction that authoritarianism, from a special perspective, it comes in many, many forms. It doesn't have something in that sense. And it's a beautiful saying, it's a beautiful idea, but I think it's not very, a little bit useful. And if there is one takeaway from this talk, is exactly that we should strive for more analytical clarity and try to understand authoritarian urbanism in a more helpful, analytical, even though narrow way. And just, again, reading all this literature, I think for me, again, the puzzling thing or the things that I struggle with is that, yeah, there are multiple terms, multiple concepts. Rarely any attempt is made to define them in a more or less analytical way. There is little dialogue across disciplines. So I try to trace, for instance, who cites whom. For instance, usually geographers cite geographers, sociologists cite sociologists, and rarely anyone actually cites the discipline that is for decades has been studied, the democracies, maybe political science. So for instance, again, specialized in authoritarianism, you rarely find a reference to, again, core political science readings where we, again, discuss the peculiarities of this concept across time and space. Also, I think for me, it's a little bit troublesome that authoritarian is applied to multiple phenomena. It can be authoritarian institutions of urban development. It can be practices. It can be policies. So I think, again, we have to maybe do some further work in terms of just trying to understand, trying to clarify what does it mean, authoritarian something, including authoritarian urbanism. And as a result, you can see in the literature that almost everything has been named authoritarian urbanism. Some evictions happening in Leipzig or construction of new capital in Indonesia, authoritarian urbanism. New projects in Tashkent, authoritarian urbanism. Again, I think this is so much room for us. I think, again, just not to disregard the previous studies, it's an important step towards more comprehensive understanding of the phenomena. But I think we also, sometimes we have to step back and think about what actually we're trying to capture in this concept. That's why I think it's worthy of trying to do some conceptual clarifications. Basically, in political science, in conventional political science, I have some ideas or consensus, I would say, but I'll keep it also to discuss it with colleagues, whether it's consensus or not, about what does, again, authoritarian politics or authoritarian, and just for the reference, I'll use dictatorship, authoritarianism, autocracies as it's interchangeable terms. So one thing I think that we in conventional political science agree upon is that autocratic politics is the politics that is based on exclusion and lack of accountability. So basically, if you, again, across multiple things like Edgemogul, Robinson, institutional studies, non-institutional studies, we agree that authoritarian rule excludes some constituencies. This is, again, the essence of authoritarian politics. And also, it excludes in the way that doesn't allow any sort of accountability. It doesn't mean that, again, all authoritarian countries are not accountable. There are like countries like electoral hybrid regimes that have some inbuilt mechanism of accountability. But in general, they lack any sort of accountability to the core constituencies. In, again, this conventional approach, elections are the ultimate mechanism of accountability. Again, we can discuss whether the representative democracy at the moment is a crisis. But basically, elections is one of the best mechanisms that we invented. So we can also talk about juries as an alternative. But basically, these are the kinds of elections that we have. And the minimal definition, the minimal threshold to define authoritarianism is about that. It's about elections. It's about having free and competitive elections. And there is, again, wonderful books like Milan Švorek, a colleague from Yale, that wrote the book justifying why this particular approach to authoritarianism. Another thing that also I think we've already started to discuss is that authoritarian countries, the regimes that we call authoritarian, they come in many shapes and forms. So just like Tolstoy's, like unhappy families, it can be multiple sorts of autocracies, electoral, non-electoral, monarchies, military dictatorships, all sorts of these neo-patrimonial regimes. So I think we have to recognize that as well, that autocracies, they are very diverse in the institutional build and in their policy-making process. Sometimes they are centralized, sometimes they are less centralized, sometimes they have elections, other autocracies do not have, but still, at the core, they have the exclusion and lack of accountability as the primary things. And lastly, I think it's also important to recognize that urban politics plays a really huge role in maintaining the stability of authoritarian regimes. There is a growing literature saying that cities have been the hotbed for mobilization for at least two centuries since the Industrial Revolution. And for autocracies right now, recognizing the threat from urbanities is an important task for if they want to survive. And hence, again, I think urban development is one of the core policies that autocrats would like to employ in order to maintain the authoritarian equilibrium. So the equilibrium, again, based on exclusion and lack of accountability. So that's my approach to authoritarian authority. Again, I'll be happy to discuss whether it's a good definition, bad definition, or anything in between. So I believe that we can conceptualize it as the set of institutions, policies, and ideational practices, meaning that some discourses or rhetorics that justify these policies and institutions aimed at preserving the authoritarian equilibrium through this means of urban development. It can be anything. Again, I'll have some examples of mine, but clearly we can discuss the wider implications. And again, to narrow down further the focus of, I think, our analysis of authoritarian urbanism, it is important to recognize that behind this authoritarian equilibrium, there are two major threats to any authoritarian rule. One is the elite fractionalism. Milan Schwartz calls it the problem of power sharing. So basically, elites disagreeing on who should be at the front, at the forefront of power. And elite fractionalism might lead to the dissolution of the whole authoritarian equilibrium. So that's why this is one of the major threats. Another one is the mass uprising. That's what we've seen, for instance, in Arab Spring events, but also across Soviet countries with the colored revolutions or failed colored revolutions like in Russia in 2011, 2012. Or it might be also called the problem of control. So basically, my argument is that authoritarian urbanism is precisely the set of these institutions, policies, and ideational practices that helps authoritarianism, autocrats of all kinds, to respond to these two threats through means of urban development. Again, special or non-special aspects, we can also discuss that as well. There are some implications on this argument. Basically, for instance, in terms of elite presence, we can argue that in order to keep elites in check for autocrats, it's important to share the rents. And urban politics, urban development provides a great venue to share the rents with the others. Also, ensuring the preferential and selective access to the policymaking is an important task for any autocrat if they, usually he, but yeah, she might be as well, they want to survive. And from that, it follows that, for instance, that's what we see actually, what we observe literally. That's if you want to ensure the preferential and selective access, then vertical centralization just naturally follows this idea. Or putting emphasis on executive rather than legislative power. And that's what we see, for instance, in Turkey, I believe, for the AKP, but also with Vladimir Putin abandoning municipal autonomy and building an institutional framework that enables mostly executive rather than legislative power on the ground. And the same is mass uprising. I would argue that, again, from this idea that autocrats should focus on the changing needs, or if they want to focus on survival, they have to respond to some core constituencies. And it's an evolving process when they in their urban politics, urban development, to the needs of these constituencies. So basically, for instance, large-scale housing projects like in Russia or in Kazakhstan, they help to survive autocrats through providing these services to working class or middle class. And I will also talk about these examples in the next section. Or manipulation of land use and zoning rules, also an important policy that enables autocrats in countries like Turkey, Russia, or Kazakhstan to build these large-scale housing projects. And that's what we observe in our research as well. And this is something that enables and something that autocrats intentionally seek to have the regulations and land use regulations that are amenable to their interventions. So some examples to illustrate this point, I have some, again, like data and, you know, field work across the, of course, basically three countries, Russia, Kazakhstan, and later on Uzbekistan. So I think one important point to make here is that in terms of elite response, if you track the data on urban development in these countries, they provide an ample evidence that, yes, the rent seeking and rent opportunities in countries like Russia are huge. So this is the data from 2017-2019, the apartments per across European countries, apartments per 10,000 populations. And you can see that Russia and Kazakhstan kind of is on the very top. Austrians as well, and probably get some more out of that. But I think it's like, again, it's a recognition that both Russia and Kazakhstan, and actually many other authoritarian countries in 21st centuries, put a lot of effort to create this huge construction and urban development industries. Even though you can spot the rooms per capita are like hinges towards the the idea that probably this housing is not very good. It's smaller than in Austria, definitely, or in countries in even like Ireland and Norway. They have two tourists per capita. Russia and Kazakhstan have about one. But this, I think, it again tells us something about these countries in terms of their the intention of this autocrats to stay in power by providing this maybe cheap yet visible services to citizens. Another illustration is just the dynamic of housing construction in Russia. Since Putin got in power in the early 2000s, until the global economic crisis, there was a steady rise of construction. There was some slowdown after 2014, but again, since 2020, since the pandemic, it skyrocketed. Construction industry in Russia is a very huge thing in terms of share in GDP as well. So I think, again, for us, it's important to recognize that it's a huge industry that has a lot of lucrative opportunities. The same thing you can observe in Kazakhstan. And again, we don't have the comparable data, unfortunately, to kind of track all this development simultaneously across Eurasia, but this is investments in housing construction. In Kazakhstan, again, there's a steady rise, and you can guess what are the cities that receive the most of these investments. This is Almaty, which is blue one, and Astana, two capital cities. One is the former capital city, and another one is the current capital city. Against the backdrop of, for instance, the East Kazakhstani region, it's many folds more investments in these capital cities. And I think it's also an important thing for autocrats. They recognize that, again, in terms of mass uprising, that's exactly the capitals that are the hotbed for anti-regime mobilization. So enjoying the core constituencies with providing housing, they're providing investments is an important task for them. And of course, if you read all sorts of outlets about construction industry in countries like Russia or Kazakhstan, you get exactly this thing. And the things have not changed much since, say, 2010. In Kazakhstan, again, communal services and land use remain the most corrupted spheres. No surprises, given that, again, this is a huge lucrative opportunity for officials, for the elites. Even and the same states right now, even though in Almaty region, so the neighboring region to the southern capital of Kazakhstan, there was a report that the head of the construction department of some district was charged with corruption charges, though 130K to 730K tenge is a very small sum. So it's a little bit suspicious that this particular head of construction was in the spotlight. There is much more corruption going on a higher level, probably. But I think, again, if you follow the news for any sort of construction or urban development in Russia, in Kazakhstan, across Eurasia, you will immediately bump into some articles about the high level of corruption there and the lucrative opportunities for the officials. The corruption is just a part of the story. So controlling elites with the rents and with money is one thing. But another thing is, of course, is catering the interests, the preferences of the general public or some core constituencies. So I have three examples from different places. So one of them is Tumen, Russia, my hometown, where I've done some field work and I observed over the years. And I think that's an important, maybe another interesting thing for us to do with the authoritarian urbanism is to recognize that it unfolds over time. And it's not just like a one-shot process. It's something that involves the historical process of interactions of autocrats with the public, autocrats with elites, and across these groups as well. In Tumen, I think one important thing for me to observe over the years is how the city changed over time to cater specifically the middle-class interests. So beautification projects in the downtown area. 10 years ago, all spots in the downtown area were designated for infill construction, but it was much better for officials to give this land to some developers. And despite all protests, they will just build some nice shopping mall or whatever. But things since 2011, 2012 for fair elections movement and other uprisings across the country, I think the regime recognized that we have to maybe provide some other things rather than just cheap housing or infill construction. So they started to build, especially in the places like Tumen, which is a pretty wealthy city in the center of Siberia. Sobyanin, the mayor of Moscow, is coming from Tumen. So they're pretty much experienced with trying to have some public beautification projects that, again, cajole the general public. Also, of course, my informants in Tumen immediately told me that it's also pretty lucrative as well. So a lot of money can be laundered from these projects as well. So it caters both the elites and the mass public by providing the first with rents and the rest of the population with these wonderful places. But also it is astonishing to observe that they just on the larger scale, or the scale of the districts, they, of course, have some huge redevelopment projects, like greenfield development projects at the places that were unimaginable, again, 10 years ago. So this is the Rechny district. So basically, in 2000, it was a residential district far from the center, from the downtown area. But increasingly, as the city grew, as this more and more housing were constructed outside this area, somehow, strangely, this district became one of the city centers as well. There was some individual housing, and basically, this is the flood-prone area. It's not very good for any sort of construction. But over the years, human city municipality was eager to provide the construction permit for first of all, evicting all the, of course, residents of this area, including gypsy people who lived there for since 1980s or something, and then building these wonderful new districts, new housing projects that, for instance, have their own embankments and their own amenities like playgrounds and everything. And the same is now happening with the right part of this picture. So a lot of housing construction here and even some luxury apartments. And if you just go there and check out what's going on there, again, it's not, 10 years ago, it could be something like really multi-store, huge apartment buildings with nothing like comfortable, nothing aesthetically luring you into this situation. Right now, what they're doing, they're like placing all these wonderful benches where you can start immediately drinking. Now or doing something else, or when you're playing checkboards over there. But this is the public place. And also, they have the sunbed. So Russians do not longer have to, or human residents, they don't longer have to travel to Black Sea or to other places. They just can get their skin pants under wonderful Siberian sun. More weird thing about this particular project is that, of course, there's a gated courtyard for the entire housing. And I like this is the project called Marvelous Corner. And I like their advertisements. The advertisement that says that it's a private territory, guarded from noise, dirt, and outsiders' gaze. Mm-hmm. So basically, again, I think when it comes to ideational practices, it might be interesting to follow up on that and think about. I think some of the colleagues mentioned that in their reviews and et cetera, that authoritarian urbanism is obsessed with cleanness, with security as the major service that is provided through this housing project or beautification projects. So this is a very interesting, again, case for me, just to track that, again, 10 years ago, this kind of advertisement, this kind of development was unimaginable. Right now, responding to this changing preferences of core constituencies, the government pours more and more money or effort to support this kind of project. And I think it's interesting that you can see that exactly happening across different countries, across Eurasian countries. So here's, again, another example of Tashkent City. International Business Center, which was like began the project to bring international investments and international attention to the city. It's basically erased the whole district. About 3,000 families had to be removed. Of course, they were undercompensated or, again, just evicted. And this is the project that is screaming that this is how authoritarian regimes deal with urban instruments, just to project the idea of comfortable, secure environment and cater, again, this changing tastes of the public, but also providing, again, some opportunities for rent-seeking. So this is how it happened in 2010. It was composed of mahalas, so it is traditional housing, individual housing in many Central Asian countries, but in particular in Uzbekistan. On the northern edges of this district, there were some Soviet-made panels and panel buildings, and to the towers, there were some official buildings. Also from the Soviet period of time. It's very centrally located in terms of city. So the presidential administration just one league away. Some other administrative buildings are all around this place. So the whole district was completely erased and built from nothing, including the Tashkent City Park, which is the response to Zaryady in the sense of it's basically also this shiny, wonderful park back in 2010. So again, the traditional mahalas, the individual housing, and this is how it changed now. So this is the multi-story, nice residential apartments, pretty empty. My informants told me that, of course, in the summer, it's more lively, it's more open to the public and stuff, but it's pretty much looks deserted in general. Again, shiny high-rises and wonderful pavements and ponds and everything. So everything to cater this interests of middle class or something, but also, of course, to project the idea that it's a competent government who's behind. It's the effort to make the public satisfied with the performance of the government. Of course, behind that, there is a lot of course, eviction, coercion. So this is back in 2010, the evidence that basically when somebody tried to confront the government with this project, they received direct caution that they're going to be reprimanded. So this is how it works. Definitely, again, exclusion is at the core of this authoritarian urbanism. People are excluded from the policymaking and from decision making. Yeah, but this is how it works. And lastly, I think another, like my favorite example is, of course, where I'm coming from, the Astana city. I don't know whether you're familiar or not, but this is, again, the new capital of Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan is the oil and gas-rich country, so it experienced also the huge economic growth. It's different from Uzbekistan on many aspects as well. So I think this, again, important to recognize that there are different contexts, but authoritarian urbanism might operate the same way. Astana is famous for its 1998 master plan. So basically, Japanese architect Kijuro by Kisha Kurakawa built a master plan which kind of envisioned the development of the city to the east and a little bit of the south. It was full of wonderful ideas, and I'd be happy to discuss with planners and everyone else why these ideas basically failed in the case of Astana. And across the over the two decades, the city developed astonishingly with the exponential growth of the population, but also territorially. And again, it's a very interesting case where there were no limits to city expansion. The city expanded enormously again in 2010. Most of these parts were, again, like individual housing or fields or like agriculture and stuff. But now it's all the housing expanded, and it continues to expand that. There's multiple problems with this kind of urban sprawl. Basically, infrastructure should collapse at some point. Politically, of course, the housing that was in this area were, again, either undercompensated or evicted. So again, a lot of coercion, which I have to admit is also part of the authoritarian urbanism. But basically behind that, there was the answer, behind this policy, there was this answer to the mass demand for housing, for accommodation. And again, it's interesting to know that like on the edges of this development, there's this mass house and cheap construction, but at the very center where there's a botanical garden, or this is a new administrative center, there is this wonderful gated luxury communities and buildings. But yeah, it's just like another to illustrate the rapid development of the built infrastructure in the city. So from the scratch to some projects, including my university, it's another by university on the right, and then to completely built environments in 2024. So to recap, so I think these are very important illustrations of how maybe authoritarian urbanism, in my, at least in my vision, operate. So it's a lucrative economic sector, no doubt, internationally and domestic. Private and public money has been poured into this construction sector and created a stable flow of rents for the local, but also for the national elites as well. So we can also, there is wonderful studies in Russia by my colleagues, Shoso and Ciela Berason, tracking the composition of state or city councils in 15 largest cities in Russia. And basically, it's proving that, yes, the construction services are overrepresented there. They're entrenched in this level of policymaking. Also, but it beyond rent-seeking, there's this huge part of the authoritarian urbanism that caters to this changing preferences of mass public from, again, cheap housing, mass housing, to some more issue, to some luxury developments. And even mega projects like Expo 2017 in Russia, or in Astana or Tashkent City, they also create this visual semblance of competent governments. So I think ideational practices are important here beyond institutions and beyond policies. Yeah, and yet at the core, it's still exclusionary and unaccountable governance. We can just wonder what additional analytical value is to this specific approach to authoritarian urbanism. I'm not claiming that my definition is this 100% good or something, but I believe by narrowing it down and by just clarifying the assumptions, clarifying our conceptual dimensions of the concept, it allows us to more systematic research on the subject. But again, some attempts have been made already, and I think further attempts are. Another thing is that once we start this systematic comparison, it would enable us to document different outcomes. So again, the authoritarian urbanism doesn't guarantee that the authoritarian equilibrium will stay. So I think it's important to compare why, in some cases, the authoritarian urbanism failed to deliver its promises, failed to deliver the stability. And again, I think it's interesting to see that this elite threat and mass threat responses to elite and mass threats can be contradictory. So you might, for instance, cater to this wonderful demand for beautification and stuff. At the same time, if the public will demand some more transparency or something like that, it would undermine the rent-seeking basis. So basically, we can further study the contradictions. I think from my perspective, like I'm doing climate change research, I think it's also important to recognize that it's a carbon intensive form of urban development. So probably we can link into this idea that we should discover alternatives, and we should discuss how this authoritarian urbanism contributes to overall, of course, GHG emissions, but also maybe how to tackle them in the perspective. And from a normative perspective, I think it, again, warrants the discussion what kind of things we might change in this world of permanent crisis, of Trump inaugurated, of the crisis of representative democracy. And so from my perspective, it looks like there is a whole discussion, of course, in political science, but we can bring it to the wider audience that there is a need for power shift. There is a need for strengthening, the rule of law, strengthening the institutions that provide accountability, including civil society and public sphere and stuff. But it's, I think, it's a very wide terms that should be more specific. And there are multiple further questions to explore from all perspectives, from sociology, from, I think, from geography, from critical geography, from all sorts of social sciences and humanities. So thank you. I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you for listening. For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigy.io.